Welcome to Meta Strategies Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Eve Behar to the broadcast. Eve is a design entrepreneur and the founder of Fuse Project, the San Francisco and New York-based design and branding firm he established in 1999. He's also the chief creative officer of Jawbone, where for the last 11 years, his products, brand, and communications work has helped the company become a leader in wearable and audio consumer electronics. Eve's also the creative co-founder of Ouya, an open-sourced gaming platform, and is co-founder of startup August, a next-generation home entry system. His other collaborations with renowned partners such as Herman Miller, General Electric, Puma, PayPal, SodaStream, Samsung, Prada, and many others have received international acclaim. Eve's works are also included in the permanent collections of museums worldwide, and he's a frequent speaker on design, sustainability, and business topics. Eve has a Bachelor of Science degree in Industrial Design from the Art Center College of Design in Pasadena, California. I recently caught up with Eve in his San Francisco office, and our conversation focused on World-Class IT Principle 1, as he discussed the process he uses to assemble a strong team, Principle 4, IT and business partnerships, as Eve discussed the nexus of design, business, and engineering, his creative methods, and the approach he uses when engaging with clients, as well as a variety of other topics. The Forum on World-Class IT is brought to you by Red Hat, the world's leading open source solutions provider. Learn more at redhat.com. So Eve Behar, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Thank you for having me.
I thought we'd begin with the chronology of your development professionally. And I wonder, in the very earliest stages of your career and maybe even your education, who were the people that influenced you? Who were the people who gave you a perspective that sort of set you down the path that has led to what you've done between then and now?
Well, I guess as a designer, there are influences that come very early on. So, you know, when I was a late teen, when I started studying design, I think I was probably 19 years old. There's certainly sort of people that are so impressive and who have done, you know, really changed culture in some ways. You know, when you look at Charles Henry Ames, for example, and when you look at people in Italy like Joe Colombo and others, you really see that intersection of design and cultural change. You know, those were certainly people I was very impressed, and having any level of that kind of influence seemed completely unattainable to me at the time.
Mm-hmm. So much of what you do is typify as art. You're sort of part artist in some ways. And in fact, your work has been in MoMA here in San Francisco and in your home country in Switzerland. Was your design always to seek commercial ends to the way in which you were doing things?
Well, there's been a split probably in the last 30 years or so between what's called the commercial arts and the notion of that some of the commercial arts is actually things that are deserving of some art exposure, you know, some cultural exposure. And I think that's unfortunate, because I've always seen the work of the designer really at the intersection of culture and commerce. So we've had many of our projects in incredible places, museums all around the world, pretty much on every continent, but that doesn't mean that they can't be at the same time in a Target store, to use kind of the complete other side of the coin there. I've always felt that the brands we work with, the work should be strong enough and there should be so much value in it that it can be displayed, it can be sold in a very high-end context, and it can also be sold in tens of thousands of retail shops.
When companies engage you, part of what they're engaging is your taste, your ideas, your vision. And I wonder, when was it when you realized that your taste mattered, or your taste was influential, or your interpretations of things mattered?
I think it took a while. When I first came to the Bay Area, I worked in Silicon Valley in the mid-90s, early to mid-90s. And I think, you know, what mattered then was, you know, our ability as designers to create a vision around people's ideas. And I considered myself kind of a draftsman of ideas. But I don't think people considered my taste as much as the ability to represent where a company would be going, where a new product or a new brand would be visible in the future. I think the notion that design is actually a strategic endeavor and a strategic tool and a strategic weapon for a business, and that taste is important because taste differentiates you from others, is something that happened a lot later.
Interesting. In your early part of your career with Frog Design and Lunar Design, you worked with the likes of Silicon Graphics and HP and Apple, especially thinking about Apple, an organization which is sort of legendary for design. Was that at all intimidating to go into an organization that was already tuned quite well, as opposed to situations where you're engaging a company that maybe you don't believe has yet a very strong sense of design?
Well, I think at the time, everybody was looking up to Apple. But at the same time, Apple, you know, wasn't seen as a successful model. You know, we tend to remember how Apple was often derided and seen as such a minor player. Was it relevant at all? In contrast to that, though, people were always talking about emulating Apple. So you had a company that had, you know, 3-4% of market share, and yet you would go into places like HP and Microsoft, and they would still be looking at Apple. So there was this, there was some contradiction. There were some schizophrenic, you know, insecurities around what Apple was doing versus Apple's relevance in the market. And I always found that really fascinating. Apple was certainly really exciting as a young designer to work with. I don't think they had found their way yet. So it was still an early time at Apple. Everybody else really did not understand, you know, all the other companies really did not understand the power of finding their own voice. Technology mostly looked at design as a way to match a competitor's feature and match a competitor's performance. And maybe look as if they're thinking about design. But they didn't understand, you know, most tech companies back then really did not understand the notion of building their own design language, building their own identity, of standing for something that is different from the competition. And those lessons, you know, were learned much later. And those were very hard lessons for those companies to learn, because mostly they saw, you know, a minor player, Apple, become, you know, the major player.
Mm-hmm. And how do you challenge yourself and your team not to replicate ideas that you've implemented before? I mean, the extent to which anyone is engaging you based upon your reputation and what you have done, and just as you say, some of the companies you've worked with, I don't know the extent to which anyone would ever have the audacity to say, we'd like you to do something akin to what you did for X organization. But how do you continue to challenge yourself to make sure that the ideas are newly created and take into consideration the context?
The idea of designing something that is like something else is just so boring. It's so incredibly uninteresting. The challenge, I mean, the reason why we get up in the morning and come to work is because we have the opportunity to create unique directions. We have the opportunity to create unique brands, unique identities. And this is really why people come to see the team here at Fuse Project, is really because they have a sense that they're going to find their own voice. They're going to sometimes stop this sort of silly game of being inspired by. Every business really has a reason of being, has unique assets, unique attributes, a unique history. And that can be turned into, I think, a very attractive design story, essentially, that consumers would relate to. But without that, they lack the communication ability of telling their own story.
That's interesting, but you also have your points of reference. You have the things you like, the things that are your own taste. So actually, when you're engaging with organizations like GE or Coca-Cola or Herman Miller, how do you imbue yourself in those companies and their values and what they've done in the past, and take that into consideration in translating what you're then going to design anew for them?
Mm-hmm. It's really, for me, a methodology of designing from ideas. So rather than starting with style, rather than starting with some superficial notions of, well, you know, my design style or my team's design style is this or that, rather really looking at a company's kind of background, history, attributes, you know, the meaning, the reason of being, as I'm saying, and taking that to a new place. a new place that hasn't been expressed by them, and certainly would not make any sense for others to express. Finding that unique direction is really key. So context, in many ways, you know, there is, you can compare that to architecture. You know, architecture that is designed with very little context, that is usually a style exercise, versus architecture that takes context into play. You know, that is really kind of the hard creative challenge every time, is to reinvent how a brand is expressed, reinvent how people will kind of appreciate what a company stands for. That's something that we've done with SodaStream. That's something that we've done with Jawbone and others. That's probably the thing that I'm proudest of, is the fact that people will look at these companies and say, wow, they're unique. They're not Apple. They're doing something completely different from others, and they stand on their own with their own design and with their own identity.
If you are going to be engaged by a company that you're not familiar with, what is your process? How do you become familiar with them? Are there certain questions you typically ask at the outset of an engagement to develop that familiarity and, again, to sort of enter the milieu of that company?
I really love to fully understand what we're entering, kind of the space, the marketplace that we're addressing, as well as the history and the attributes that a certain company has. So for me, it's so critical to be close to, you know, the CEO, close to the top management, close to people who've been there for a long time, as well as close to people who are coming into the company recently, and to listen to them. I mean, it's a lot about, as I say, being there, which is to be there in person, to walk around the facilities, to ask a lot of questions, and to understand both the, you know, the dreams and the realities that these companies are facing and have as a potential. So it's really important, this sort of human interaction, this this exchange of ideas is really important to creating good design. And that's why we tend to be engaged with our partners for long periods of time. You know, with Herman Miller, which you just mentioned, we've been working with for 11 years or so. With Jawbone, it's been 12 years. You know, with SodaStream, it's, you know, now 5 or so. You know, things get better over time, and you become a beholder of a company's identity, in a sense, and a company's ideas just as much as the people who are internal there. So I love the idea that we're, you know, we're deeply engaged, and we just have as much as much love for those brands and as much conviction for those brands as the people who work there.
Part of the power of Fuse Project is that you operate at the nexus of design and engineering and various business disciplines. Mm-hmm. A lot of the companies you're working with probably still have traditional silos and don't necessarily collaborate in the way that your company collaborates. To what extent, as you contemplate the way in which your ideas will be implemented, is there any necessity for a different kind of collaboration on the company's end, or a bringing together disciplines in ways that they had not done traditionally?
So Fuse Project was formed in 1999, and the notion behind it, which is, you know, alive and kicking today, is the idea of fusing different disciplines, of bringing user experience, of bringing brand and graphic design and packaging and identity, of bringing industrial design, engineering, innovation, all around the same table. And, you know, our teams are just absolutely incredible at their own discipline, but most importantly, they're incredible at partnering with each other. They're incredible at the cross-pollination that happens between these different practices. And that is extremely difficult to practice for large companies that have been siloed. But I can tell you that that's what they want. I mean, every single company that comes here wants the integration of different disciplines, wants to be able to tell a consistent story, you know, across their marketing and their product and their services to their customers. And they realize that a siloed approach has really passed as a way of doing business.
by virtue of engaging you, there's an acknowledgement that they recognize they need to be thinking differently. It's not typically a surprise to them when you say you're operating the wrong people or not a complete list of people are in these meetings, for instance, or at the table making the decisions. Yeah.
I think they're really excited about the potential. And in many ways, you know, we allow a lot of those different disciplines to come together. We empower them to collaborate. Usually this is a charter that is very much a part of the projects that we do, is, you know, we want our people to work with you across all these different disciplines and to work together. So I like to think that sometimes we operate as a bridge between different siloed organizations and practices within the large businesses we work with. It's definitely not easy. I mean, for us, it's something that just comes so naturally. If you come around our space and you visit our space, you will see that everybody works together and projects are simply displayed all around the space on walls, and people participate and add to the projects, you know, freely and across disciplines. And sometimes we try to recreate that kind of context at our partners, at our clients' sites as well.
And I wanted to ask you, the balance between spending time at your client sites versus them coming here, for instance, how do you balance the two of those? Is most of the work done there, or do you often invite them to engage you here?
It's really mixed. I mean, for some of our partners, building a product, an innovative product, is certainly something that happens internally. So when we work with Herman Miller, there are dozens of engineers working on our products at their sites. So we may place people there for months at a time. We may have a room here or a space here at Fuse Project that has this project environment that they can come to. It's very much the same at Jawbone, who is located about two blocks from our office, and we have an entire space dedicated to the integration of design and engineering and user experience here as well. You know, this notion of collaboration is absolutely necessary to be not just sort of a nice kind of tagline or a nice way to present the project, but it's something that has to be practiced every day. So every situation is a little bit different, but we do spend a lot of one-on-one time with all of our partners.
You've mentioned, understandably, user experience in several of your answers. How do you think about user experience? How do you engage your customers to understand what might delight them, to draw insights or to develop ideas that are beyond what they are currently contemplating, but logical in terms of what they will want to buy, what they will want to experience?
What's interesting with user experience is that people sort of think of it almost as a product of the internet era. They think of it digitally first. But what's the true story of user experience is when you look at Braun, so a consumer product company from Germany, was doing in the 50s and 60s, when you arrange the buttons on a physical object in a logical fashion so that users can easily go from function to function, you are doing user experience. So Dieter Rams, you know, who was leading Braun, really was as much a kind of form giver and identity giver to Braun, you know, which was the largest consumer brand, you know, at the time. But he was creating a very logical and easy to use, easy to operate user experience. Then, you know, it certainly has been a practice that has become even, you know, further in the forefront since the digital age. And being able to create unique user experiences as well as kind of falling within expected behaviors are basically the kind of challenges that that we have to tackle every day. Hmm. What's, you know, as far as engaging with users, for me, it's always critical to spend, you know, time just observing people, observing the way they use current products, observing the frictions that happen in that process, observing the ways that we may be able to shift them to different user experience models, so what we sometimes call mental models, which are ways in which somebody uses a product or expect to use a product or service in a logical and repetitive fashion. This is sort of the hard work of design, recognizing existing behaviors and finding ways that new behaviors can be simplified and can become more delightful.
We talked a moment ago about the not only Fuse projects bringing together people from very diverse disciplines, but that's being reflected in your clients to a greater extent by the way that they then collaborate and then collaborate with you. I wonder, the traditional silos of companies are decades old and almost militaristic in terms of their background, this sort of hierarchy that cascades down through the org structure and has, you know, very distinct silos between disciplines. But now there are so many companies that are gaining tremendous advantage. We've named several of the ones that you work with, for instance, gaining tremendous advantage in thinking about that differently and identifying and training and grooming people who operate at the nexus of multiple disciplines as opposed to simply being a marketer or an IT specialist or a fill-in-the-blank product or service area. How do you see companies evolving in terms of the way in which they're organized by virtue of the, you know, the experiences that you've had with a number of very meaningful ones?
Well, the need to evolve is there simply because design and identity, which is a resultant of design work, really cuts across all these different disciplines. And designers are really in a unique position to pursue these ideas across these different silos and disciplines. And so, you know, you really see the advent of designers as bridge makers, you know, across the different silos. And so I think the way I have seen companies do it is having a discipline that, you know, is very much the interdisciplinary sort of champion within, you know, within a business. So when you're creating a new design, let's say a new product, for example, who is going to bridge the gap between marketing, engineering, your technology group, your R&D? You know, who is going to create the kind of consensus that brings these people around the table, gets them all really excited about creating something that has, you know, success potential? I think that's very much a designer's role. As much as to partner on the vision, as much as to sort of create the implementation, the execution, you know, to start from strategy all the way to how something is made and produced and eventually displayed, sold, and experienced, this is the concern of the designer. So it's a very wide concern, and, you know, we're in a great position to be able to bring people together around that.
You are of Turkish background. You were raised in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. You're based in the U.S. now. I'm sure that you're very sensitive to different cultures and different tastes that are reflected in those different cultures. Almost all, if not all, of the companies that we've spoken about operate globally. Mm-hmm. And to what extent is geography and the cultures of those geographies something that you take into consideration? And how do you find taste or reaction to products differing depending upon the marketplace that your clients operate in?
Well, I think for me, growing up across so many different cultures, you know, has done two things. In a way, it makes me understand the particulars of the different cultures and where people come from. It also makes me understand what are the universal kind of values across those different cultures. And so what I have found is that with products and with experiences, a global view is going to be a lot more successful. It doesn't mean that there aren't ways that products get localized, both in the way that they're sold, in the way that they're advertised, and sometimes in the way that they function or the amount of options that you give to people. But most importantly, brands have to stand for something across cultures and across a global marketplace. And if you can stand for something in this way, globally, then you very much have a chance of building a global brand, to say it simply. And I think that's, you know, when we look at some of the emerging markets, if we look at China and others, I think that still is a sort of core challenge. You know, when you look at America, if you look at Silicon Valley, we're very good here at building global brands. And while we see the emergence of local brands in other places, the question for me is always, great, there's a big marketplace over there, can get lots of customers over there, but the next step And the challenging step is how do you build a brand and identity and a user experience that can be global.
What are your sources of inspiration? How do you, since as you've described, you are always making sure that you are and finding ways to make sure that you are not simply repeating yourself, but challenging yourself, challenging your team to come up with fundamentally new ideas each time you're engaged by an organization, or as you're engaged anew with an organization you've been working with for 5 or 10 years. Mm-hmm. What are your sources of inspiration and new creative ideas?
So this is, as a designer, this is a question that you get a lot. You know, what inspires you? What are your sources of inspiration? It's a legitimate question, and I think it speaks to the notion that people are inspired by a sort of a singular point of departure. I don't think that's the way kind of the modern designer thinks or should be thinking. My sources of inspiration are really ideas. So they're not visual things, they're not forms, they're not colors, they're not shapes. They're really ideas. And this is what I find extremely exciting here, being here in the Bay Area, and is the fact that people really follow ideas. They really have a vision, they really have a new perspective, a different approach, and those are the things that are inspiring. The scientists, the technologists, the entrepreneurs with whom I have these types of conversations are really sort of my inspiration in many ways. So in a sense, my inspirations aren't things that are already here. They tend to be things that we can imagine, you know, things that we can explore in the future. And that's probably why the work here isn't style-based, isn't form-based. It's really idea-based.
Yeah, it's interesting. I would think that one of the wonderful things about this line of work is that every day in your personal life, these ideas might emerge in your walk to work, in your travels, in your conversations, mm-hmm. that all of these are potential sources of inspiration, right. As opposed to, as you say, not one single publication that you're reading or show that you're watching or any sort of traditional, you know, ways of consuming culture.
Well, a question I get a lot, not from people who live here in the Bay Area, but I get a lot from international media, is what makes San Francisco, what makes Silicon Valley different? And for me, it's exactly what you describe, which is the notion that ideas is what drives us. Not so much markets, not so much specific kind of cultural point of view, but really change. And we're addicted to change. We're addicted to new ideas. We're addicted to new concepts. And I don't know of another place in the world that has, that transforms its people. I mean, when I came here, I was in my early 20s, and that's not the way I grew up to think. That's not the way Switzerland and Europe thinks. And I don't think that's the way that any other culture that I know of thinks. So, yes, that's what you do here. You get up in the morning, you walk around the streets, you observe behavior, you observe the idiosyncrasies of modern and contemporary life, and you wonder if there are other ways that that we can experience this life. I think that's really the beginning of every new idea, every new business in this region.
It's been very interesting to see universities like Stanford and Carnegie Mellon begin to develop programs that are beginning to combine design, engineering, and business disciplines. In some ways, a reflection of a lot of what we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. What role do you see universities playing in developing this sort of talent to think the way that you do and think the way that you would advise your clients to think?
When I came to the U.S. again in the early 90s, there was less than 1% of the population that understood what design was. You would tell people you're an industrial designer, and they would immediately ask you whether you were designing factories, manufacturing facilities. And the understanding of design has changed tremendously. I mean, I think, if we've seen 1,000% more understanding and more interest and more excitement about what design can do, and how simply because people experience design now much more on an everyday, in the everyday. So when I look at teenagers, when I go speak at colleges and universities, the interest in design is tremendous. Not everybody wants to be a designer, but everybody knows that they're going to be talking to one at some point. And everybody wants to have a role in this creation economy that we're in, that I was just describing, in this place where ideas and change are driving us. And so I think it's great that, budding entrepreneurs and business people in universities, that engineers, electrical engineers, mechanical engineers, aspiring marketing folks are want to sort of come together and understand it better. And I think universities have been successful at bringing people together to start learning about the process of collaborating, so to start learning about the process of creation, to start seeing how actually hard this is, how building things, how presenting new ideas, how carving out a market is just something extremely challenging. I definitely think there is a role for universities in bringing people's skills together, starting to train people to have that type of horizontal understanding between the different disciplines, and how that allows for the generation of new concepts, new products, and potentially new businesses.
How, I'm sure you have no typical day, but how do you organize your time? How do you work regular hours? Do you mix that up at all? Do you take breaks in the middle of the day, start late, end early?
I think in modern life, there isn't such a thing anymore as a schedule,
right?
As a regular schedule. I think I work all the time, but it's also my life calling. So I guess I'm also hopefully having fun most of the time. Sure, people come to work early and stay late. I think this is a kind of creation culture that we understand from startups and design firms and highly motivated teams. But for me, the most important part of my day is being in the creative lab, designing, drawing, talking, moving ideas forward and moving them through the different execution cycles that we have here. So I'm really engaged most of my day in the creative process. I'm very lucky because the structure of Fuse Project is that I have a business partner, and so I'm not one of these designers that has turned into a small business owner. Rather, I'm a designer that's the same thing I want to enable out of my teams, is for our creative people to continue to be creative at the highest level and to have a structure here that supports the business running to have a healthy company as well.
Lastly, I wanted to ask you what you're working on now, the extent to which you can share some of the things that you're working on, thinking about, etc.
So what I'm working on now is always quite similar to what we've worked on yesterday. So people always want to know what's new, but in many ways, when you are engaged with partners, and our business model is really favors kind of these long-term relationships. So when you engage with Herman Miller, when you engage with Jawbone and SodaStream and the numerous other partners we have, you tend to sort of continually build on previous lines of products or create new lines of products with the technologies that we have. So the next line of Jawbone products, the next office furniture system, we're launching a collaboratively based office furniture system, the first of its type, that really actually encourages people talking and collaborating. It's something we're doing with Herman Miller, and it's launching as we speak. And then I also have a few startups. I'm the co-founder of August, and we're getting very close to launching the Smart Lock. That's a very, very exciting prospect. A lot of excitement in the marketplace, but also with consumers for these types of products. So it's a mixture of new, exciting products that we're going to have to prove in the marketplace, like August, and continuing work with our known long-term partners.
Sorry, I said last question, but I have one additional one. You're sure. Involved in so many different companies. I'm a member of the actual team, founder of four or five currently, that you're actively involved in. How do you split your time between those?
So my time is really, as I said, dedicated to the creative process. And we have teams for all of these companies that we're either co-founders in or certainly partners in. And I essentially split my time, between different needs. Sometimes I may be spending 2-3 weeks, mostly on a single problem, on a single, because we're in a heavy sort of creative rotation and a heavy sort of creative need. And sometimes it's a little bit more in a maintenance cycle and support cycle. So I'll say I spend 150% of my time on all the projects that are at a key creative moment.
Excellent. Well, Eve Behar, thank you for joining us in the Forum on World Class IT and sharing your many experiences and perspectives. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you very much.
The Forum on World Class IT would like to thank Red Hat, the world's leading provider of open source solutions, for being our corporate sponsor. Red Hat is a catalyst in communities of customers, contributors, and partners creating better technology the open source way. Connect to an ecosystem of innovation at redhat.com today to learn more. Listen to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategy's Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of world class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.